The viewpoints expressed in the following program are not necessarily those of WRUU, its license holder, or its staff. The following program contains subject matter and realistic language that some listeners may find objectionable. Listener discretion is advised. Well, good afternoon, Savannah. It is just past 12 o'clock on this Friday before Christmas, and that means you are listening to Literature on WRUU 107.5 FM. I am Lee Rich, and here as my co-host is Mr. P.T. Bridgeport. Here at Listening to Literature, P.T. and I like to examine thought-provoking books of the present and the past and offer listeners book news, reviews, and interviews. So, P.T., what do we have in store for our listeners today?
Oh, I'm P.T. this week?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Weren't you P.T. last week?
Yes. Maybe we should try switching, although I don't think people would buy that.
Yeah, maybe not. Yeah, sometimes I say Listening to Literature with P.T. and Lee, or Lee and P.T., but I don't know. We sort of look alike, don't we?
Not even remotely.
Which is probably good for the both of us.
Probably so. Let's see. But the question was, what do we have this week? We have three holiday stories. Holiday stories that people don't generally recognize as holiday stories, but they are just the same. And I have some recommendations on books to buy or to ask for the holiday, and I'll bet you do too.
I do, and I know we're cutting it close. The holidays are almost over, which is hard to believe. It feels like they came fast this year.
Well, if you insist on panic buying, books is one of those things that you can do that for.
Right, and you know, I think you can never go wrong when you buy books, but maybe there are a few out there that you do want to be careful of. So I know last week we took a look at a Hanukkah story, so this week we have some Christmas-related stories, but the first one we want to talk about is one that actually you suggested, and like you said, it's not your run-of-the-mill Christmas story, one that people might not know about. Who's the author, and what's the name of this story?
Okay, the author is Damon Runyon, who wrote a whole bunch of really interesting short stories during the 1930s. And the story itself is called The Three Wise Guys.
Exactly. See, Christmas theme, can't you tell?
Now, yeah.
Now, P.T., I know, though they might not realize it, many people actually know Damon Runyon's work. What are some of his more popular stories, and how might people have come across Damon Runyon's work before?
Most people now come to Runyon through the Broadway musical Guys and Dolls.
Right.
And if you've ever attended that, his entire body of work is in just about that language. It's a combination of mock official and lots of Broadway slang and mostly in the present tense.
Yeah, right. I mean, and scholars have actually termed this Runyon-ese. So like you said, it's in part formal and in part colorful slang. He doesn't use contractions, and he almost sort of, maybe he didn't come up with this originally, but he writes everything in what you might call the historic present.
He does. And for New Yorkers of the time, especially those that were born in other places, it was something that a lot of the storytellers did wherever they came from, because that was the easiest for them to negotiate.
Right, absolutely. And we'll talk about how you came to Damon Runyon and his work and what I know of Damon Runyon. We'll also take a look at that story, The Three Wise Guys, very, very Runyon-esque, and he's got those Runyon-esque characters. We'll talk more about that. One of the pieces, background pieces I pulled up is from the Denver Press Club. And this is actually titled Damon Runyon, the Man Who Invented Broadway. So P.T., how did you kind of came to Runyon from his work when he was a journalist in New York, is that?
Yes, he wrote both for newspapers and for magazines. He wrote for magazines like most writers once he established a reputation with the newspapers. I think maybe that description is off a little bit. Broadway was there.
Right.
But he was the one, I think, who most faithfully reproduced it in print.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, it's interesting. So I know Damon Runyon's name in particular from Denver. which is where I'm from originally. Although Runyon spent a good portion of his life in New York and really covered the New York scene, like I said, in the 20s and the 30s.
Late 20s and the 30s.
Right.
He was essentially a Depression writer.
Right.
You run across some of his characters very occasionally, who are well off, usually because they're in some sort of racket. But most of them are lacking capital, shall we say.
Absolutely. And the interesting thing is that Runyon was actually doing fairly well financially during the Depression era, just unlike his characters.
Well, for one thing, he was employed, which was better than a lot of the people he was hanging around with at the time.
Yeah. You had kind of given a nod to what people call Runyon-esque characters. Who are some of the characters in Runyon's story, whether the story we're going to look at today or some of his other stories, and what makes them Runyon-esque?
Well, first off, Broadway, the Broadway culture at the time, not necessarily plays, but the people who hung around Broadway at the time were people who were seeking excitement. They were people who perhaps wanted to get in show business, perhaps didn't. They were people who weren't really all that interested in staying within the law, shall we say.
That's right.
This was, again, the Depression. It was Prohibition. Between Prohibition prohibiting things that everybody was doing, and the unemployment and the general economic problems, these were people who were scraping along day to day.
Right.
And they developed their own little culture in doing so. That sounds awfully pretentious when you talk about this thing, but it's true.
Right. And you and I have talked before that Runyon, a lot of Runyon's characters are actually based on real people, or he sort of blurs fact and fiction?
They are. A lot of the incidents that he recounts have their basis in reality. He wrote one about a very influential gangster who got shot and looked for a place to go home, and the story is his encounters in the various different homes he had. The incident, the shooting, actually happened. The character was recognized as the nickname of an actual gangster.
Okay.
There's that sort of thing. One of the characters who pops up occasionally in his stories is somebody named Waldo Winchester, who's a newspaper gossip reporter, and is clearly Walter Winchell.
Right, and he and Walter Winchell were friends through most of their lives.
When they fell out, it was kind of a long fall, but for most of their lives, they got along well together.
Right. And the story you're referencing earlier, is that The Brain Goes Home?
The Brain Goes Home.
Okay, right.
Other things he did, if you're a fan of old Bob Hope movies, there's The Lemon Drop Kid.
Right, with Frawley. Is that William Frawley?
I believe so.
Okay,
all right.
All right, we might have to look that up.
And then there was another one. I've forgotten the name of the movie, but it was based on a story called Little Miss Marker.
Yes, and that was Shirley Temple's breakout. It was turned into a film, right?
It was turned into a film.
And that was Shirley Temple's breakout film, I believe.
Ah, okay.
Right. So, yeah, so, I mean, even if you don't know it, almost everyone out there probably has come across the Damon Runyon story in one way or another. And before we get into the three wise guys, let's talk a little bit about Damon Runyon's background. He kind of comes from a line of newspaper men.
All right. This is where I have to defer to you. I know his stories. I don't know much about his background. And it turns out that you from Denver know far more about that than I do.
And I'm certainly no expert, the little that I know about it. But the interesting thing is growing up in Denver, in Colorado, I knew the name, I heard the name lots of places, but I actually didn't really know a ton about Damon Runyon until you and I met a while ago.
Well, let's start with basics. He came from Colorado, right?
Well, he was born actually in Manhattan, Kansas. And his grandfather was in the newspaper business, and his father was also in the newspaper business. And from what I read, and this a really nice summary of Damon Runyon's life and his work comes from the Denver Press Club's website. And the Denver Press Club hosts the Damon Runyon Awards every year. And this summary was written by Michael McClanahan. But McClanahan talks about how Damon, and interestingly enough, he was not known as Damon Runyon until quite a bit later. He was Alfred.
Alfred, yeah.
Or Al Runyon is how he started out. But Runyon's mother, dealt with consumption, right? Had tuberculosis. And it was because of that that his mother and father, with him as a young boy, moved to Pueblo, Colorado. And I have to add a little personal note in here. In part, that's why I'm from Colorado, because my great-grandfather, who was from New York, living in New York, they got moved out to Colorado because of his consumption. And so he was originally born in Kansas, but he pretty much grew up in Pueblo, Colorado. He only had about maybe a fourth grade education. But by the time he was 15, he started working for a Pueblo newspaper. And one of the interesting little tidbits of his life happens there, where there was a typo in his byline. Originally, he was Al Runyon, R-U-N-Y-A-N, and the typo changed it to R-U-N-Y-O-N, and he thought, all right, let's go with that.
Okay.
All right.
And did I notice that there was some sort of circumstance where they left a sister in Kansas?
Yeah, he had a few sisters, I think three sisters, and the family did leave the sisters in Kansas. And so it was pretty much Al Runyon and his parents who moved to Colorado. And his mother eventually dies, I believe. But Al Runyon, he really starts his life in the newspaper business, does a little stint in the Spanish-American War, comes back eventually, works for the Denver Post, when the Denver Post was really a fledgling newspaper trying to beat out the big guys, like the Rocky Mountain News.
That's interesting, because having become familiar with him from his New York experience, you'd never dream that he came from anywhere else.
Right. But he seemed like he was a New Yorker through and through.
He really did.
Right.
He so faithfully reproduced the language and the attitude and all that you'd really think he was a native.
Right. It seemed like, though, he loved, during his journalistic period, he really loved talking with people and interviewing people and really picking up their story. And he seemed like he had a talent for tapping into people's vernacular.
He did. And it's something that I don't know that he started it, but New York has had a tradition of that. A.J. Liebling, about the same time, did the same thing. After him, Jimmy Breslin did that and did it wonderfully well.
Yeah, absolutely. And Jimmy Breslin actually has quite a bit to say about Damon Runyon as well.
Oh.
Yeah, which, maybe we'll get to on another show.
Maybe we can.
Right. If you're just now joining us, I'm Lee Rich, here with Mr. P.T. Bridgeport, and we co-host Listening to Literature on WRUU 107.5 FM. We are talking about some lesser, maybe not lesser known, but lesser discussed Christmas stories.
Oh, and certainly lesser known.
Certainly lesser known. So we've been talking about Damon Runyon's The Three Wise Guys, and maybe we'll get into the story here in a few moments. So Runyon, he got fired from the Denver Post, eventually starts working for the Rocky Mountain News, and spent quite a bit of time and was on the board of the Denver Press Club. What do you know of Runyon's character? Why might he have gotten fired from a newspaper? He was a very hardworking employee and a great writer.
He was a hardworking employee who was a fine writer. At the bottom, he was a storyteller. He may have sometime let factual reporting and storytelling overlap. Right. He was a very hard-living man. Right. He liked his liquor. He liked his tobacco. Yep. And he seemed to be fairly fond of females, too.
The ladies as well, right?
Yes.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
In his reporting, many, many people loved what he did, but there was always an accretion of people who felt that he'd slighted them or insulted them or something like that somehow, and I think that eventually built up, too.
Yeah, absolutely. His scandalous habits. Sometimes he wasn't necessarily a well-liked person.
He was no angel himself.
That's
personally,
right.
So
well, once you start to read some of his stories, you can see, you know, I don't know if you can come up with those stories if you were an angel. He eventually moves to New York to become a newspaper man out in New York. And it was there that one of his editors said, Alfred Damon Runyon is too long of a byline, and they chop off the Alfred, and now we have Damon Runyon.
Damon Runyon.
All right. Well, let's take a look at his Christmas story, The Three Wise Guys. P.T., do you want to get a setup about...
Okay, I will. This is the beginning of the story. And since these people are who they are, I'm quoting now. I'm not talking about myself.
Exactly. Okay. And let's say this was originally published in Collier's magazine in 1933.
Okay. One cold winter afternoon, I am standing in the bar at Good Time Charlie's Little Drum on West 49th Street, partaking of a mixture of rock candy and rye whiskey. And this is the most surprising thing for me to be doing, because I am by no means a rum pot, and very seldom indulge in alcoholic beverages in any way, shape, manner, or form. But when I step into Good Time Charlie's on the afternoon in question, I am feeling as if maybe I have a touch of the grip coming on. And Good Time Charlie tells me there is nothing in this world as good for a touch of the grip as rock candy and rye whiskey, as it assassinates the germs at once. It seems that Good Time Charlie always keeps a stock of rock candy and rye whiskey on hand for touches of the grip, and he gives me a few doses immediately. And in fact, Charlie takes a few doses with me, as he says there is no telling but what I am scattering germs of my touch of the grip all around the joint, and he must safeguard his health. And it goes on from there.
Absolutely. So you have the narrator sitting at, and I'm assuming this story was written during Prohibition, even though...
Oh, certainly.
Right, Prohibition does get repealed in, what, 1933, but he wrote this story during Prohibition. Do I have that? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, actually, December 5th, 1933, so I guess.
Yeah. It's interesting, but after Prohibition had been repealed, some of the little joints in New York actually kept on going because they were so popular during the Prohibition time. And maybe Good Time Charlie's was one of those.
Maybe Good Time Charlie's was one of those. So we have this narrator sitting in Good Time Charlie's. Who do you think this narrator is? Is this narrator a piece of Damon Runyon himself?
I think it is. I think he told lots of stories from kind of a narrator point of view. And I think in the process of doing that, he developed a character for the narrator. And in talking about how he never indulges in alcoholic beverages, well, that may be a little personal fib.
That's right, exactly. I mean, he eventually gives up alcohol in his own life, though not smoking. But yes, he liked his alcohol well until that point.
He did, and the narrator certainly does if you read the whole bunch of stories.
That's right. So there's a fib within a fib in this story.
Yeah.
And while he's sitting at Good Time Charlie's, this narrator, in walks Blondie Swanson. There's another example of some of the names that Damon
right.
Runyon would come up with. The Brain.
Right. That's the way people were known then. It turns out later in the story that Blondie's proper name is Olaf, and
right.
so
right.
maybe that's why he used Blondie.
Blondie, right? You don't get that until the end.
But Blondie is one of the more reputable citizens around, being a famous and reputable bootlegger.
That's right.
And he's come in to announce that he's finally leaving the business because he's lost a love because of her disdain for his business. And Blondie is followed by a third character who's much more shady.
Yes, right. And maybe eventually once we talk about our other stories for today, we'll talk about sort of if there's any morality tales running through this. Blondie Swanson seems, even though, like you said, he's, you know, on the edge of the law, he still seems like he's a good guy. Maybe the narrator is, too. The third gentleman who comes into the story, the Dutchman.
The Dutchman, right? Yes.
What do you make of him?
Well, the Dutchman, the focus of the story is the Dutchman is not a nice person, and he's recently fallen in with a bunch of people who specialize in going into small towns and holding up banks or telegraph offices or whatever. And it turns out that the Dutchman has just recovered from some bullet wounds he sustained when the police followed one of their escapes and, in fact, killed the other gangsters.
Right.
And what he's done is he's stashed the money in a barn, and now he's all ready to go and get it back.
Right, and now he needs some help.
He needs help, and so Blondie is a reputable and well-known man of fine reputation, so he recruits Blondie, and the narrator pops along too.
Right, and so let's give a couple of examples from Damon Runyon's story, The Three Wise Guys. We're talking about, so this is Depression era, talking about breaking into safes, right? And here's what Damon Runyon says as the narrator in this story. This is once quite a popular custom in this country, although it dies out to some extent of late years because they improve the brand of safe so much it is a lot of bother knocking them off. But it comes back during the Depression when there is no other way of making money until it is a very prosperous business again. And then in order to get the narrator the narrator just decides to sort of hitch on to this plan, right? And here's what the narrator says, right? It seems that the Dutchman does not care for rock candy and rye whiskey, even without the rock candy. So Blondie, Swanson, and me, and Good Time Charlie continue taking our doses, and Blondie keeps getting more enthusiastic about the Dutchman's proposition, until finally I become enthusiastic myself. And I say, I think I will go along as it is an opportunity to see new sections of the country.
And he does. The thing that I found interesting or cute or whatever you want to say is halfway through the session they run out of rock candy.
That's right.
And so the drink after that is known as rock candy and rye whiskey without the rock candy, and it comes up four or five times. It's how they sustain themselves on the trip down.
That's
as well.
Right. It's still medicinal, though.
Very medicinal.
Even without the rock candy.
And as is known even to this day.
That's right. And you can see in Damon Runyon's story and his writing, he sometimes sort of develops, if you want to call it a cadence, where he'll have these repeated phrases of the rock candy and rye whiskey without the rock candy, or always calling Blondie Swanson, Blondie Swanson. You sort of see this repetition and this rhythm going through his stories.
And there's that, and then he sets something up and then deflates it, if I may.
Yes.
Blondie is talking about his personal record, and he says, I retire from business because I am 100% American citizen. In fact, I am a patriot. I served my country in the late war. I am cited at Chateau Thierry. I always vote the straight Democratic ticket, he says, except when we figure it's better to elect some Republican. I always stand up when the band plays the Star Spangled Banner. One year, I even pay income tax. And of course, I know that many of these things are true, although I remember hearing rumors that if the draft officer is along half an hour later than he is, he will not see Blondie for heel dust. And what Blondie is cited for at Chateau Thierry is for not robbing the dead.
Absolutely. On that note, let's take a quick break for station identification and a few announcements. And when PT and I come back, we will maybe finish up talking about this story from Damon Runyon, the three wise guys. Talk about when these three wise guys get to a barn in a snowy field. And then we'll move on to our second story of the day. We'll be back shortly. This is WRUU-LP, Savannah, Georgia, 107.5 FM, WRUU.org. We are Savannah Soundings, community radio with global soul. Well, PT, it looks like some of our technology is not working with us today, so we might have to do a few of our announcements live. Would you care to maybe share a public service announcement with our readers?
A public service announcement. I would be happy to. This particular public service announcement comes from the Georgia Historical Society, which actually is one of the places I know, and I have a good relationship. I like those guys. Anyway, the Georgia Historical Society will present Super Museum Sunday. That's on February 10th, when dozens of participating Georgia historic sites, homes, and museums will be free and open to the public from 12 to 4 p.m. For more information, visit GeorgiaHistory.com. And if you are not familiar with the Georgia Historical Society yet, that would be a good thing to take up. They have some interesting things there.
Absolutely. Well, we've been talking a little bit about history today, woven into this story by Damon Runyon, yeah. The three wise guys. So these three wise guys, the narrator of the story, maybe alter ego for Damon Runyon himself, Blondie Swanson, a bootlegger, but a kind-hearted bootlegger, and the Dutchman, bank robber, maybe not so nice guy, although a little bit later in the story, he does give us a sense about how there's honor among thieves.
Well, he has his personal sense of honor, and he doesn't, I'm not sure how many other people he shares it with, but he has his own sense.
He has his own sense. He's definitely the least reputable character, I think, of the story. Well, the three of them, they're trying to go to this barn where the Dutchman had buried the stash of money from one of his prior robberies, and they come across this barn that is surrounded by snow. And this is in Damon Runyon's story. This is Blondie saying, "The snow on the ground is anyway a day old. There are no tracks around the door of this old joint, going or coming. And it is a cinch if anybody knows there is a sick doll there. They will have plenty of time to get help before this. I'm going inside and look things over," Blondie says.
Yeah, this is because in finding the barn, they find that there's somebody living in it. And it's apparently a woman who's in some distress. She's screaming.
She is moaning and screaming and absolutely in distress. And maybe Blondie and the other gentlemen don't realize it right away at first. But what is this distress that she's in? Speaking of Christmas stories.
Well, she, as it turns out, is pregnant.
Yes.
And as it turns out, along with robbing banks as an accomplishment, the Dutchman is an experienced midwife, having performed the service for several of his children.
And I think, if I remember correctly, I think it's about eight children.
About eight, and I think there was one that didn't survive the experience, but 8 out of 9 is still a pretty good percentage.
Maybe one of the reasons why
for home births. Yeah,
maybe one of the reasons why the Dutchman needed all that money to begin with.
Could well be.
Now, this story, The Three Wise Guys, is in the public domain. And, you know, I don't know about you. I don't know about what you do in your household over the holidays and over Christmas that's coming up. But you could, you know, pull together your family. Maybe your dog Stink might like to listen to you read The Three Wise Guys.
I don't know that he'd be all that comfortable with New York slang, but right. I'll give it a shot.
Right. Yeah, some of the language that Damon Rennie does use, you might have to have your internet handy nearby so you can look some things up. One of my favorites is...
And my dog isn't that good at tracking things down on the internet.
Maybe really not. He has his, his good traits and his deficiencies, right? So the narrator says at one point in time, after the baby is born in this barn, surrounded by untouched snow, the narrator says, "Well, the old Dutchman is as proud of this baby as if it is his own. And I do not wish to hurt his feelings, so I say that the baby is a Darbaroo." Have you heard of this term, Darbaroo, before?
I have not, but I'm guessing that it doesn't mean angelic or anything like that.
I did. I had to look it up, but it does mean it's a good thing.
Okay.
It is a good thing. So if you would like to find out what happens in this story and how this story might relate to other Christmas stories, you can take a look at Damon Runyon's The Three Wise Guys.
Yes, please do.
All right. P.T., before we move on to our next story, which is The Adventures of the Blue Carbuncle by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, should we maybe share with our readers an announcement for how you can contribute to WRUU via individually or as a business?
Well, I think that's just a dandy idea.
All right. Well, I guess all we have to do now is actually find that, or maybe
actually fine. Yeah,
we'll take a look for that while we're starting to talk about The Adventures of the Blue Carbuncle, and we'll come back to that at some point in time.
Okay.
All right. So the Adventures of the Blue Carbuncle. This is a Sherlock Holmes story, obviously written by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, originally published in the Strand magazine, January 1892. So we're going back a little bit further than the Damon Runyon. So,
yes.
So tell us about, before we get to the story, P.T., what's your take on Sherlock Holmes? Are you a Sherlock Holmes fan? Are you an Arthur Conan Doyle fan?
I am a Sherlock Holmes fan, maybe even more than Conan Doyle was. He got kind of tired of the character at one point.
Yeah, he sent the character to his demise at one point, correct?
But yes. He seems to have hit the popular consciousness hard again, because there have been now TV shows and movies and some people putting some fairly strange characteristics on the stories and the characters. I particularly like the British series that updates Holmes.
Right.
The one with Bernard Cumberbatch.
Benedict Cumberbatch. Benedict Cumberbatch, yes. Yeah.
Because they've captured the spirit of it and updated it. Some of the others are nice tries.
Nice tries, sometimes yes. Hit and miss, absolutely. And of course, if you know me and other people who do know me, I'm a huge fan of House MD, which is loosely based on Sherlock Holmes. But really, actually, House MD, I think, as the character, Dr. House, is, I think, more based on Dr. Bell, which was Arthur Conan Doyle's, one of his mentors when he was studying to become a doctor himself.
That could well be, but I wasn't aware of the connection. Now that you mention it, they're both variably sociopathic.
And, yes, very much so.
Have their own way of doing things, and they both have personal failings that occasionally get in their way.
Absolutely, and that's, I think, personal failings are what make good characters, right?
Absolutely.
So here, The Adventures of the Blue Carbuncle. P.T., set us up a little bit. Sherlock, is it where?
Well, okay. The thing, if you read this in order of the Sherlock Holmes mysteries, he's just had times that have been kind of rough for him. Two stories before this, he's had to retrieve Irene Adler's letters, and she is always an unspoken but very real presence for him. And after that, I believe, comes The Speckled Band, where he's dealing with poisonous vipers, which can't be much fun.
Right.
And it's come the holiday season. I think he's feeling a little washed out.
It seems like it. Yeah. So he's here maybe trying to get a little bit of a reprieve now that it's Christmas.
Yeah. And he notices or he has something brought to his attention that isn't going to engage him terribly, but something he feels is kind of interesting. And so he launches on the adventure of the blue carbuncle. Now, I think of carbuncles in more or less a medical term, but that isn't what he means here.
I do, too. Coming from, you know, teaching in health and health sciences, I think of carbuncles as boils or other types of, maladies of the sort, which is not what like I said, which is not what Holmes is thinking. And in fact, later on in the story, almost at the very, very end, Holmes does talk about this story and this problem that he solves as a singular and whimsical problem.
Yes.
Right.
Well, it is a whimsical. Any problem that starts with the crop of a goose is going to be kind of whimsical.
It doesn't. Although it starts with a hat first. And
that's right. The hat comes first.
I was almost thinking that this story could be called, you know, the adventures of a hat, you know, right. Or really, I think in the end, the case of the mistaken goose.
There you go. There you go.
So let's read maybe a little bit of the beginning of this story, and then we can talk more about what exactly Holmes means, and Conan Doyle means, really, of what a carbuncle is. And we'll go into the story a little bit more. So this is The Adventures of the Blue Carbuncle, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, from Strand Magazine, January 1892. Go ahead, P.T.
Okay.
All right.
I had called on my friend Sherlock Holmes upon the second morning after Christmas, with the intent of wishing him the compliments of the season. He was lounging upon the sofa in a purple dressing gown, a pipe rack within his reach upon the right, and a pile of crumpled morning newspapers, evidently newly studied, near at hand. Beside the couch was a wooden chair, and on the angle back hung a very seedy and disreputable hard felt hat, much the worse for wear, and cracked in several places. A lens and forceps lying upon the seat of the chair suggested that the hat had been suspended in this manner for the purpose of examination. "You're engaged," said I. "Perhaps I interrupt you." "Not at all. I'm glad to have a friend with whom I can discuss my results. The matter is a perfectly trivial one." He jerked his thumb in the direction of the old hat. "But there are points in connection with it that are not entirely devoid of interest and even of instruction."
Yes. And as per many of the Sherlock Holmes stories, Sherlock Holmes then asks Dr. Watson, "What do you make of this?" And Watson can't come up with very much, which he sort of scoffs at his counterpart, and then launches into all the details about who this hat wearer might be. But in addition to the hat that's been brought to Sherlock Holmes, what else comes with it? A goose.
A goose.
Yeah,
yes.
A goose, right? What? Go ahead, P.T.
Well, the goose is something that was brought by the commissioner, is it?
The commissioner, yes.
Yeah. And it turns out that when the commissioner started to process the goose, he found a huge blue jewel inside.
Yes, in the goose's crop.
In the goose's crop. Right. And it is so large that they refer to it as a carbuncle,
which
is where that comes from.
Right. So it's a gem, right? Not a
gem.
Boil, like you and I are thinking
yes.
about. And, of course, that commissionaire takes the goose back to his family because they figure, look, we can't find the owner of this hat and the goose,
yeah.
and why waste a good Christmas goose?
So we should say that they came into possession of this the commissioner saw somebody being set on the street, and he helped rescue the guy, but the guy dropped his hat and the goose.
And his goose, and runs away.
And runs away, and so there's the commissioner with a hat and the goose, and he found the jewel and the goose, and he decides that it's time for Sherlock Holmes.
Right, absolutely. And one of the interesting things that I like about this story, there are many things I like about this story, but the fact that Sherlock Holmes spends the first part of the story, you know, doing his thing and impressing his friend Watson about how much he can deduct from this hat, about the hat wearer. But Sherlock Holmes isn't the one who finds the blue carbuncle. It was only found once the goose has been cooked and processed and cooked.
Oh, not only that, but once he's done all his deductions, the next step is to find out who might have been the original owner. And it isn't Sherlock Holmes who goes and contacts all the newspapers and so forth. It's Watson, as is his habit.
Yeah, absolutely. And the person, and we won't ruin the story for you, the person who has stolen this blue carbuncle and hidden it inside a goose mentions late in the story, and I was trying to find the actual phrase here, maybe I will, I'll flip through some of my pages, mentions about how he came up with this idea to hide the gem in the crop of a goose. And this was a means that would baffle even the greatest detective. And in a certain sense, it actually did. Even though Holmes solves the case, he didn't know about the blue carbuncle to begin with.
It did, but if you remember, it also baffled the perpetrator because the geese got switched.
Yes, right, which is why I like to call it the case of the mistaken goose, or a story about a hat, a goose, and then two geese. Absolutely. Are there any particular points in this story that any phrases or paragraphs that you find moving, or should we maybe move on to talk about J.R.R. Tolkien?
The only thing that I think is really exceptional that we haven't discussed is this is one of those cases that do happen occasionally where Holmes gets tired of the whole thing and lets the bad guy go.
Yes, right.
Because somebody else has been accused, but the case against the non-perpetrator is going to disappear.
It's going to disappear, right?
With the perpetrator. So, okay.
Right. And in fact, actually, it was a question I was going to ask you that I forgot about. Both of the stories we've been talking about today, Damon Runyon's The Three Wise Guys, Arthur Conan Doyle's Sherlock Holmes, The Adventures of the Blue Carbuncle, both of these stories kind of let the bad guys kind of do get off in the end. Do you think there are some morals to this? To these stories? Are these just fun stories? Are these stories about forgiveness during a holiday season? What's your take?
I think it has a lot to do with the societies that they're talking about at the time. There's that famous comment that the laws of France prevent both the rich and poor from sleeping under the bridges of Paris. The law as written does not generally take into account the lives of the very poor people who are dealing with what is to them an alien culture, people who are just getting by. They develop their own sense of morality. And in some ways, it bends toward the shady. In some ways, it doesn't.
Right.
For example, if you are in a fix and you want to, if you need help in getting out of it, quite often it will be the people who have less than that will help you than the ones who have more. This was one of the great lessons of the Great Depression. Yeah. People didn't have much, but they were so aware that other people had even less, and if they could, they'd be willing to share.
Yeah, absolutely. And we won't ruin the end of either of the stories for you, but in Damon Runyon's story, The Three Wise Guys, the people who are maybe not acting in such a legal or proper manner, they actually do make, at least a few of them, do make some right decisions, and those right decisions actually come back to save them. And if they hadn't made these decisions, it might have gone the other way.
And if there's any miraculous content in it, I think it's in just that.
Absolutely. So it's about 12:49. PT and I are going to keep talking. We're going to tell you about a Tolkien letter, and if we can, we'll try to squeeze in some book recommendations, last minute gift recommendations, and we'll end on a song before we turn it over to Jen, who is sitting in for Tim, and not fade away. PT, should we talk a little bit about Tolkien? Should we? I think we need to mention Tolkien.
Okay, let's do that. He's kind of a fascinating character and very different from the sort of stories that we've been covering. For several years, he wrote a Christmas letter to his children, his two boys.
Right, and then his other two children who get born after
right,
that. I mean,
right.
He did this over like a 23-year period.
Right.
He wrote these letters as if he were Father Christmas, correct?
He did. And like so much else he did, when he pretended to be Father Christmas, he did an outstanding job. Father Christmas is supposed to be pretty old, so he wrote in a very artistically shaky script. He produced little drawings to go with it.
He's a great illustrator.
If you can see the original, it's very, very nice, very, very well done, and far beyond a Christmas letter to children.
Absolutely. And these letters have been collected. You can purchase the whole collection, I think they're called Letters from Father Christmas, including Tolkien's illustrations. His illustrations are great. We have an excerpt from one letter that was written by Tolkien as Father Christmas in 1925. And it's actually the address on the top of the letter, the return address. It says Cliff House, top of the world, near the North Pole, Christmas 1925. And you might think, well, wait a minute, why is Father Christmas not at the North Pole instead of near the North Pole? P.T.
Well, it all happened like this. One very windy day last November, my hood blew off and went and stuck on top of the North Pole. I told him not to, but the North Polar Bear climbed up the thin top to get it down, and he did. But the pole broke in the middle, and it fell on the roof of my house, and the North Polar Bear fell through the hole it made into the dining room with my hood over his nose. And then all the snow fell off the roof into the house and melted and put out all the fires and ran down into the cellars where I was collecting this year's presents. And the NP Bear's leg got broken. He's well now, but I was cross with him. He says he won't try to help me again. I expect his temper is hurt and will be mended by next Christmas.
J.R.R. Right. Tolkien's one of his letters from Father Christmas from 1925. Over many of these letters, he writes about the hijinks of the North Polar Bear.
And other clumsy animals and elves and what have you.
Right. So they're fun. They're beautifully illustrated.
Right down the alley for children of late single-digit age.
Right, absolutely, absolutely. Now, PT, before we talk about the music we might end our show with, we've just got a couple of minutes. We can either talk a little bit more about Tolkien himself and maybe his religiosity and how he came about it, or we can talk about a few book recommendations that you might have. And I'll save mine for one of our shows coming up. Maybe you can buy some gifts or buy your own in the new year. So, PT, what do you have?
Well, I'm going to try and leave some space for you to make your recommendations. So I'll go through this quickly. Of the new books, there's a book called Library, which is about the life and times of the Los Angeles Library. It was written by Susan Orlean, and it's quite a charming book. I enjoy it.
And we might do a show maybe based around that at some point?
I would hope so. Okay. Let's see what kind of interest we can get. There's a book that came out earlier this year that's still selling very, very well. It's called Educated. It's by a woman by the name of Tara Westover, who started out being very badly homeschooled and went on to actually earn a doctorate at Oxford, I believe, okay. or Cambridge. Well, okay. over there, anyway. Two other books you might consider. One is a recommendation. I don't know. I haven't read it. But it's called Where the Crawdads Sing. It's by Delia Owens, and it's the story of a girl who starts out in backwoods North Carolina. And the second is called 21 Lessons for the 21st Century. It's by Yuval Harari. I read a previous book of his, which was interesting. I can't subscribe to everything, but it was interesting.
Okay.
And if amongst older books, there are several things I could recommend. They're all my personal favorites, and people who know me have heard about them. So we need to go into that. Lee, what do you have?
Well, maybe we'll talk about some of your older books on another show. Okay. I'm kind of like you. I tend to love older books. I love new books, too. One of the new books that my book club just finished reading is The Overstory by Richard Powers. In a nutshell, it is a book about trees, but it is even more than that. If we had a little more time, I'd read a quick excerpt, but we don't. But take a look at The Overstory. Richard Powers, I think, is a very lovely writer. He brings to his writing and to his books multiple perspectives, technological perspectives, environmental perspectives, philosophical perspectives. It's a very interesting read. I'm not saying that it's necessarily a very happy read in a lot of ways, but I am so glad that I read it. One of my all-time favorite books that I always recommend and I give as a gift to people in my life over the years is The Eight by Catherine Neville. And this is a relatively old book. It's a novel. It is a novel about a quest for Charlemagne's chess set. And it's actually written in two time periods. You have a computer expert in the 1970s telling one part of the story. And then you have two nuns in the south of France in 1790 telling the other part of the story. And so each chapter is from these two different time periods. You know, I never really thought about this too much when I read it, but one of the reasons why I love the story, in addition to all the artistic facts and mathematical facts and historical facts and the characters she weaves in, this is also a story about heroines. There are four heroines that tell this story, and Catherine Neville includes 32 historic characters in this novel and 32 modern characters. All right, so we are at 12:57. We are just about out of time, and I want to give our upcoming co-host some time to get set up. So, PT, go ahead and give us a little brief take on what song we're going to play to end our show, and then I'll do some ending announcements.
Okay. To end the show, we're going to do a song as we normally do that relates to literature. This particular one is called The Mists of Poe, and it's from Chris Spheeris and a nice Greek man. It's from the album Enchantment.
All right. Well, PT and I want to thank you for listening to Literature Today. Good day and good reading. The viewpoints expressed in the preceding program were not necessarily those of WRUU, its license holder, or its staff. This is WRUU LP, Savannah, Georgia, 107.5 FM, WRUU.org. We are Savannah Soundings, community radio with global soul.